Okay, so I'd like to start by thanking the organizers for giving me this this chance to talk. I'm going to be talking about stochastic aspects of cardiac arrhythmias. It's a topic that I think is very interesting and important, and it's one that hasn't been discussed too much at this conference, but it is related to some things that have been talked about. For example, the issue of why the patient died on the Monday and not the Tuesday, and why, for example, an abnormal complex here, a premature ventricular complex, in that instance leads to the onset of ventricular tachycardia, whereas a seemingly identical PVC here doesn't do that. Okay, so there are many sources of noise on the heart. The heart sort of sits in a fluctuating environment. You have differences in neurotransmitters, variation in hormones. You might have differences in drug concentrations. But the source of noise that I'm going to talking about specifically is single channel noise. So the noise due to single channels in the membrane opening and closing in what seems to be a stochastic manner. And it's sort of a good starting point because it's actually a type of noise that if you know what type of channels you have in the membrane, you can actually reproduce the single channel noise very well. And that's sort of what I'm going to be talking about first, an example where we in a model, a single channel type of model, compare the amount of fluctuations with those seen in a similar, in like a real preparation. Then I'm going to give two examples of how this single channel noise might have to do with arrhythmia. And I'm going to be talking about the effects of single channel noise on the phase resetting of cells and on the generation of early after depolarizations. So this is a recording done by some of our coworkers. It's a whole cell patch clamp setup. And they record the transmembrane voltage, here's a function of time, from small clusters, so 2, 3, 4 cells that are well coupled together of these embryonic cheek ventricular cells that beat spontaneously. So you can see here the spontaneous generation of action potentials. So this rhythm looks pretty regular, right? But if you chop it up and superimpose successive beats, you can see that there is actually an appreciable amount of noise here in the interbeat interval, for example. So we have previously formulated a deterministic
question. So yeah. Do we know for sure that this kind of variability comes from the fluctuations in intrinsic noise in the channel, or more from variations of expression levels?
Well, the expression levels will be on a different time scale.
A different time scale, even on this. So it's not beat to beat, sure. But
well, we compare what we do from the experiment is like 100 beats or so. That's like 40 seconds typically with this interbeat interval. So it's on a fairly short time scale.
Well, if you record for a long time, the variability does it stay constant or does it drift?
The action potential morphology will change. Because you basically wash out the sodium channel will sort of slowly decay. The sodium current will decay with time. So it's not really possible in a preparation like that to look at expression levels. Okay, so we have previously published a Hodgkin-Huxley deterministic model that reproduces the waveform seen in the experiments. And then what we do is we change that Hodgkin-Huxley type model into a single channel type model by replacing here in the Hodgkin-Huxley formulation, as you all know, you compute the currents by multiplying the macroscopic conductance times perhaps one or more inactivation variables, gating variables. In a single channel model, you compute the currents by multiplying the single channel conductance times the number of channels that are open. And there's sort of standard ways to count the number of channels that are open. There's, for example, the Gillespie method. So you need the extra parameter that you need for a single channel model is a single channel conductance for each of your time-dependent currents. And hopefully you can find that in the literature. If you can do that, You can, from the macroscopic conductance and the single channel conductance, compute what are the number of cells, of channels of the different types that you have in your model cell. Okay, so we do the simulations. And
the calcium dynamics important in this dendritic cell?
No, I hope not, because we haven't included very much calcium dynamics. These are 7-day-old ventricular cells, and the calcium dynamic is at best very immature at that stage. So with just the voltage-dependent inactivation, you can reproduce voltage clamps experiments of inactivation, and we think that calcium is not very prominent. Yeah. Well, I think perhaps a factor of 2 or something like that. And it actually scales, the irregularity scales with 1 over the square root of n, so sort of accurate to 1 over the square root factor. Okay, so in the model, I show here the tough traces. These are spontaneous action potentials. They look quite regular, right? But if you superimpose them, you can see that there is some irregularity, and it's sort of fairly comparable to what we see. This is in one of the clusters in the experiments. There's quite a lot of cluster-to-cluster variability in this preparation, perhaps due to different expression levels. It might be due to differences in how much the isolation procedures damages the individual cells also. So I'm just going to show you here averaged results. So these numbers here are coefficients of variation, the standard deviation normalized to the mean of various action potential parameters. And what I show here, there's one row here with the results from the model, and here's the average from many clusters. And it sort of agrees fairly well. There's about 4% CV in the interbeat interval. There's a certain amount in the action potential duration. There's more in the diastolic interval, which is the phase here. And a lot of that irregularity in the DI, the diastolic interval, comes from irregularities in the rate of diastolic depolarization. That's the slope of phase 4 here. And it sort of makes intuitive sense. That's a part of the action potential where the total current is very small. Things are changing slowly. So if you have additional current noise during that phase, you'll have a larger relative contribution. Okay. We've actually done quite a lot of analysis on the experimental data to see how consistent the data is with a random process, and specifically how consistent it is with this specific random process from the single channel model. And it all agrees fairly well, and everything is consistent. So at a cellular level, it seems like the amount of noise present, at least in this system here, is very consistent with that coming from the single channel noise. It is 3 cells coupled together, but they're well coupled, and we treat the preparation as isopotential. They're small cells, the embryonic cells. They're very small compared to the adult cells. Okay, so I'm going to switch gears now and talk about how the single channel noise may affect phase resetting. So in a phase resetting experiment, I think Leon has talked a little bit about that. Basically, you give a small perturbation in these experiments. It's a short current injection. And for a fixed amplitude and duration of that injection, you can do a sort of a systematic experiment where you vary the phase at which you give the stimulus, or the time in the unperturbed cycle here at which you give the stimulus, and then you can map out the effect of that stimulus by measuring what happens afterwards, what's the effect of that stimulus. So the experiment that I show here, it's a phase resetting experiment. It was done by Michael Guevara. This is from a paper published 20 years ago. And this is from an embryonic cheek cell aggregate preparation. It's a preparation where you have hundreds or thousands of these same embryonic cheek cells coupled together. But actually, the fact that there are so many cells coupled together changes things. It's actually quite a different preparation from the cluster preparation. And I'm also going to use another model on the next slide to simulate the behavior in those cells. So these experiments, the first row, the upper row, this is not working so well. Okay, the upper row up here, Michael used a coupling interval. That's the timing of the stimulus of 141 milliseconds. The vertical line here is a stimulus artifact. And you can see that the actors on each, in each row, there are 10 or 8 or so identical experiments where he used the same coupling interval superimposed on each other. Okay, so at a coupling interval of 141 milliseconds, in 8 of 8 cases or 10 of 8 cases or however many it is, you get no response following the stimulus. The rhythm is slightly delayed, hard to see on that scale. But that's consistent in all those 10 traces. At a coupling interval of 143 milliseconds, so just 2 milliseconds later, it's a short amount of time, you can see the intrinsic rhythm is perhaps around 500 milliseconds. So 2 milliseconds is only a short fraction of the intrinsic rhythm. So just a little bit later, in 10 out of 10 traces, the stimulus evokes an action potential immediately following the stimulus. At the intermediate coupling interval of 142 milliseconds, you can see it better here perhaps, in some cases you get an action potential right away, and in other cases you get a delay before the occurrence of the next action potential. But there are no intermediate responses. So if one were to compute what's called a phase transition curve based on these experiments, just measuring where you, the phase at which you end up compared to the phase at which a stimulus was given, you would get a discontinuous curve. There would be a jump discontinuity at a coupling interval of 142 milliseconds where the curve would be bivalued. So there's actually been done quite a lot of theory on phase resetting and topology of phase resetting responses, a lot of that initiated by Art Winfrey. And there's a continuity theorem that builds on that. It is due to Guggenheimer. And that says that if you have a discontinuous phase transition curve, then you should be able to annihilate the rhythm. So these experiments seem to violate that theorem. There's a discontinuous curve, but there's no annihilation. So it was suggested already back by these creative guys in 86 that the solution to that apparent paradox might be that the continuity theorem builds on continuous ordinary differential equation. And that is, may not be, or is not, a very good way to simulate these, or to describe this preparation where you have the stochastic effect of the noise. So we set out to try and simulate phase resetting experiments like this in a single channel model. The model is basically the Urasawa Noma model with the sodium current, or a larger sodium current. And what we get in that model is phase resetting responses that are very similar to the experiments that I just showed. You have a coupling interval of 116 milliseconds. You get a delay before the occurrence of the next action potential. In here I showed 10 cases superimposed. The only difference between the 10 cases is that they start off with a different seed for the random number generator. And here, similarly, for a coupling interval of 118 milliseconds, you get an action potential right away following the stimulus in all 10 cases. And then at 117 milliseconds, you get either or.
This model is a deterministic model where you're just adding some amplitude of noise?
No, it's also a single channel type model.
And so the noise just comes from that?
Yeah, this comes from the stochastic gating. Okay. So in the model, you can, of course, do more than 10, repeat your experiment more than 10 times. In the experiments, you're sort of limited by the lifetime of the preparation. But we've actually done sort of here, we've done 1,000 manifestations of this experiment to see if we would get something intermediate and if there would be eventually what would correspond to a continuous phase transition curve. And what happens even in 1,000 trials, you can see here, this is a histogram of the time for the occurrence of the next crossing of zero on the voltage axis. And all the responses fall into two fairly narrow peaks, right? So you can sort of fit those if you want to for fun and calculate probabilities that you fall within here, and that probability is very, very, very small. Okay, so you'd never see responses like that in these types of models. So, yeah? All of them except the background or the leak. The leak, we don't know what channels describes it, so everything else. Just like a potassium, a sodium, and a calcium, and I forgot what else.
Can you explain again what the probability prediction would be?
Yeah, it would be that eventually, as these responses, so there's a small perturbation. If you think of it just a sort of in mathematical terms, you have a limit cycle, you perturb it, and you come back to the limit cycle. You can compute the old phase is the phase at which you give the perturbation, and the new phase is where you come back to the limit cycle. At least in the models, you tend to come back to the limit cycle relatively fast. After a few rotations, you're pretty much very close to it, at least. So the prediction would be that after a few rotations, the responses should sort of be, there should be a continuous range. It shouldn't be like a discontinuous jump between the types of responses. Don't steal my thunder. Okay. So, yeah, so what happens here, right? Yeah.
In theory, based on very small.
Perhaps, if I may stop you, perhaps we can wait with your question. I'm not sure exactly where you're going, but I'll just show what happens in the deterministic model. Okay, so in the noise-free model, this is the same trace as on the previous figure. This is what happens in the deterministic model, the noise-free model. The trace here, the black trace, is at a coupling interval of 117 milliseconds. So same used up here. You get the non-response, the delay before the next action potential. And in the deterministic model, you can vary the coupling interval very finely, right? So at a coupling interval of so much, you get the red response here. And at a coupling interval, just a little bit later, you get the blue response here. So I made it purple where they're sort of virtually superimposed. Okay, so in order to understand what happens, why you get these very different traces, I'm going to show in the next slide exactly what happens. And it's important to appreciate what happens because it'll also tell you why you get the response here in a single channel model. So what we did to figure it out was we reduced the original model as a seven-dimensional model. We reduced that down using standard tricks down to a three-dimensional model so that you can actually plot and visualize trajectories and manifolds and whatnot in a 3D space. So what I show here, the black curve here is the unperturbed limit cycle. And then in the three-dimensional model, you have the same type of behavior with a coupling interval of, you know, whatever much gives you this blue response here. And a little bit earlier, it gives you the red response here. So you have the same kind of abrupt transition between responses. The gray surface here is the slow manifold. You get it by setting dVdt equal to 0. And what you see is that you get this abrupt transition when stimuli brings you from the limit cycle here around location A to around location B here, which is very close. So this is called the unstable branch of the slow manifold. Then the trajectories actually follow that for a while before they diverge in opposite directions. Okay, so trajectories that have the property that they follow the unstable branch of the slow manifold are called Carnot trajectories. And it'll take just a second to show why. They were first described by a French mathematician in a two-dimensional Fijinagumo type system. So this is there's a cubic noncline in a two-dimensional system. It's a slow manifold there. You can have trajectories special trajectories, if you vary a parameter very finely, that do something like this. They run around here, just like your normal action potential would do. They cross over to the other branch, and then they actually fall off here. Okay, so instead of where the normal action potential would go all the way over to the other branch here. So then you can actually draw a little something here. Okay, so it looks like a duck, right? Kana means duck. So these are kana trajectories. Okay, so when I was doing these simulations, I was essentially stuck here because I couldn't change the coupling interval any more finely than what I was already doing. I was doing normal numerical integration. So I couldn't see if there was a real discontinuity, which there shouldn't be because this was a noise-free model. So we hooked up with Sebastian Dudel, who some of you will know as the author of this auto software package. And one of the things it also can do is it can do continuation. So instead of doing numerical integration in forward time, Sebius looked for continuation, like, and looked for solutions between the red and the blue trajectories here. And he found, yeah? This one? Oh, it looks like a pen. Oh, okay, thanks. Okay, so what Sebius found was that there is a family of trajectories, these magenta trajectories here, that lie between the red and the blue trajectories and which give the continuity of the phase transition curve. So basically, these trajectories, you only get them if the stimulus is very, very, very well timed. They have to be very close to this region here, which was around location B over there. They travel down here. So I should say that the model has an unstable fixed point located here. The fixed point has one stable and two unstable eigenvalues. So it travels down here in the stable, in the direction of the stable eigendirection, down to, there's like, and then a two-dimensional unstable manifold, which is spanned by the two unstable eigendirections. They travel down towards that plane, and then if they're very well timed, they can travel in this direction here before diverging off. And these traces here will actually give the continuous response. But what happens if they're not exceptionally well timed, just very well timed? They will fall off this branch here, and this is the fast direction of the slow this is a fast unstable direction. So this direction here is characterized by a large eigenvalue. It just means that you can easily go in this direction unless this is an exceptional trajectory. So what we conjecture, this direction here is actually the direction of the slow unstable manifold, so the smaller the two positive eigenvalues. And so what we conjecture is that there is a stable manifold of this branch here. And if you're on either side of that, you will go either in the all direction here, the non-direction there. Okay, so the details are a little bit, it seems a little bit complicated, but it's just the point is that we know that there is some kind of structure in the phase space of the system. We call it the stable manifold or the weak unstable manifold, and depending on whether you land on either side of that, you'll go either in the all or the non-direction. Okay, so these Kana trajectories are because of the separation of time scales that you have one very large eigenvalue and one not so large eigenvalue. These Kana solutions are notoriously unstable, and we can do sort of for fun a back of the envelope type of calculation to show that the opening of a single sodium channel for a typical amount of time will actually be enough to send you sufficiently far away from that stable manifold to give you the behavior that we saw in the single channel simulation that gave you the either or type of behavior. Okay. Okay, so what does this have to do with arrhythmia? Well, one thing might be that you can be very close to a region where an abnormal beat, say, instead of the perturbation we use in these simulations, you can think of the perturbation as, say, a premature ventricular complex that can give either, you're very close to the sensitive region, can give you either action potentials in neighboring cells, say, or it cannot. Right, so they can be very sensitive dependents. One way to get premature ventricular complexes is through early after depolarization generations. And early after depolarization is this one shown here. It's an additional depolarization before the action potential repolarizes fully. So what I show here is simulations where we show on the left simulations in a noise-free model, and on the right, simulations from a stochastic model. So one way to get EADs in, it's known in the clinic and in experiment, is to give a potassium channel blocker. So what we do in the simulations is we progressively block a potassium channel more and more. So here at a conductance of the 1.7 nanosiemens, which is reduced to its default value in this model, you get in the noise-free model, you just get this nice periodic behavior, no EADs. But if you add noise, you can actually start to get, excuse me, the occasional EAD. Here, there's a histogram, and actually here, at this value, EADs occur so rarely that you actually can't pick them out in the histogram. Yeah, this is tick embryonic cell model, and this is actually not a single channel model, it's just with added noise for simplicity.
Mm-hmm. There are experiments that show something like that?
There are experiments that show, they show EADs with blocking the potassium current, and they also show sort of an irregular pattern of the occurrence of the EADs. So if you reduce the potassium conductance even more, you're still in the region here at 1.6, where in the noise-free model, you don't get EADs, but in the stochastic model, you actually get quite a lot of EADs here, around every third or so action potential. So that's an example of where being close to a bifurcation point, but where you're not quite over it in the deterministic model. In the stochastic model, that bifurcation is still manifest, even though you haven't crossed the border. At a slightly lower potassium conductance here, 1.59. In the deterministic model, you then start seeing EADs, and they occur periodically. And what you see is there are actually three peaks here in the histogram. So one peak here is for the action potentials that have an EAD. That's a very long interbeat interval then. And then you have two others. And there are two others because the action potential following an EAD tends to be shorter than the one coming before an EAD. Okay. In the stochastic model, you don't see that kind of pattern. So again, you see irregular occurrence of EADs, and you don't see the separation of the intermediate intervals. They all sort of merge together here. Again, at an even lower potassium conductance, you see two EADs following each action potential, and in the noise-free model, in the stochastic model, you can see irregular behavior. So the main point that I want to make out of this is that in the stochastic models, you can get dynamics which are qualitatively different from the dynamics in the noise-free models. And we think that these stochastic effects will become prominent, especially in situations where you cross a bifurcation slowly. So some bifurcation between normal and abnormal dynamics, let's say the onset of cardiovascular disease on a very slow rate, but it can also be on a not so slow rate, say for example variations in the drug concentration and things like that. But if you're close to a bifurcation point for an extended amount of time compared to the heartbeat, you'll see these stochastic effects. Finally, I'd like to thank my collaborators. A lot of this work was done when I was at McGill working with Michael Gavarni on glass, Claudia Lerma did the simulations, the EAD simulations I just showed. As I said, we collaborated with Sibrius on the phase settings, showing that using continuation methods. And the experiments using the chick cluster was done by collaborators in Graz in Austria, and they also helped in sort of formulating the deterministic model. And I'd like to thank you for your attention.
One of my students, just for one of group meeting, we put channel noise in Fisunagumo just for fun.
Yeah.
And I remember that when we got to 10,000, then the variability was very small. So I mean, for an adult ventricular myocyte, with the numbers are closer to 10,000 and 400 per channel. So would, I mean, these effects
yeah.
still be there, so close to any bifurcation, you know. Separatrice of attractors, you know, you always see the noise on any scale. But
yeah. Yeah.
The question is, you know, are they amplifying chick embryonic cells with just smaller number of channels?
Yeah, a little bit. In adult ventricular cells, in single cells, it's been shown that the that don't beat spontaneously. You can look at the irregularity of action potential duration, and the coefficient of variation is on the order of 1 or 2%. So there's still some irregularity. But when you couple cells together, that irregularity will decrease. But you can still have, it's not crazy to think of a situation where you have, for example, an ectopic focus or something that is dominating the effect. Was your question answered? Okay, good.
Yeah, I like the EAD simulations.
Yeah, in panel D here, there are a few, not in this trace, but there are actually a few EADs here if you look for longer time. A few APs that don't have an EAD. So, yeah.
And in these models, experimental models, it's always sort of mystifying the fact that there'll be 2 and 3 and 1 and 4 and sort of where all that comes from.
Well, I mean, okay. You have the whole, the EADs are coupled to the whole calcium cycling machinery, which is, you know, very stochastic. Right, so that wave, that spontaneous release. So, you know, even though they're triggered by the reopening of the calcium current, and even that's controversial, I could see, you know, a major component of stochasticity coming from calcium system.
Mm-hmm. I suspect it's less stochastic than these, and there's a number, so maybe a huge number of channels.
Yeah, but you have, you know, so once you start loading the cell, you have this transition from, you know, sparks to micro sparks to waves. You have, you know, clusters of these running down channels. So, you know, you start to see the heterogeneity of the calcium cycling machinery, and then that enhances the stochasticity.
But normally the thing goes up in one, right? And the waves are not the normal situation.
That's right, but the EADs...
And you synchronize thousands and thousands of channels.
But the EADs are very often in a regime where there is calcium overload, right? So...
Yeah, but I think there's also... You know, the other component is the repolarizing current, because frequently in these models, anyway, what you see looks like all of that repolarization. Mm-hmm. So at some point, you either come back to minus 85, or you just sit up and rain and rain and rain.
Mm-hmm.
So it's been sort of mysterious as to, you know, why? Why does it suddenly get to a linear potential where it will completely repolarize? And this could be part of it. Obviously, there's a lot more going on in terms of calcium, and that's probably affecting the repolarizing currents as well. So,
I'm just curious. Let's say you coupled a group of cells which were all slightly different but still deterministic. Let's say you change some parameter by a small amount.
Yeah.
You say the same, the shape space would still be the same, or the same structure. You could have a couple dynamics.
Well, you'll still have periodic behavior. So you won't see this, you won't see sort of the irregularities that you see. You might still see then that you can have EADs occurring before the bifurcation point in the homogeneous model, let's call it. But you won't see the irregularity. I'm not sure. To be honest with you, I've never really understood what a stochastic resonance is. So actually, I'm not sure. The way I see it is just you're close to a bifurcation point, and then you can start, you know, things are a little different in some of the beats, so they might effectively have a larger potassium current corresponding to a larger potassium conductance in the deterministic model, so you can sort of flip across the bifurcation point.
Any more questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you for staying on time.